This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Looking to start a side hustle or become your own boss? Do it with Shopify. Whether you're selling succulents or stilettos, Shopify has the industry-leading tools to help you create, control, and grow your own business. So get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.co.uk/special offer.
Welcome to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan. Now, often, whether consciously or not, I project my own experiences onto the diverse pathways to immigration, assuming that many immigrants share similar journeys. However, while researching for this particular episode, I realized how limited my understanding of the immigrant identity truly is. Today's interview unveils some niche, heartwarming stories about Bengali immigrants who came to the US in the 1920s, during a time when Asian immigration was banned. And I'm so excited that together, you and I will explore themes of cross-cultural and interracial solidarity, unconventional routes to the American dream, and the grit and perseverance of these early pioneers. Our today's guest is Vivek Bald. He's a filmmaker, writer, and a scholar. His work centers on the South Asian diaspora and migration to the US and Britain. He has spent the last 25 years shedding light on the untold stories of South Asians through his documentaries, books, and his teaching at MIT's Comparative Media Studies Department. Vivek's collaborative research underscores the influence of South Asians in the Western world and how their presence has shaped the culture of cities like New York, while also depicting the political undertones. His new documentary, In Search of Bengali Harlem, recently premiered in early March and tackles the lost history of the immigration of Bengalis to New York City in the 1920s and their settlement into Black and Hispanic communities within Harlem.
From 1966 to like 1970, in that apartment on 102nd Street, it was my father, brother Kareem, and my mom. When I came into the picture, my father went on a waiting list at Carver Projects. So they went from this little tenement to this more spacious project apartment. And you know, growing up in East Harlem, I was Bangladeshi, I was Muslim, I was getting bullied. My mom, like in kindergarten or first grade, she would come with a sari. She had a strong accent. And all the kids were like, yo, your mom talks funny. What's that she's wearing? Why is she wearing a curtain? I'd say, no, that's a sari.
Oh, and by the way, you will hear dog barking throughout the interview for the most part, and it's okay. It was Vivek's neighbor's dog, so we couldn't really do much about it. But we all love dogs, right? Why not? So without further ado, let's get started. Welcome to Immigrantly. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Before our recording, I mentioned I can see tabla in the background. And you said you used to play. Why did you stop playing?
As a teenager, I was studying the sitar actually quite intensively and a little bit of tabla, but I got sort of lured away by punk rock. I was a punk rock drummer.
I really like the intersectionality. Vivek, as I was researching for this episode, we found a lot of information about your documentaries, books, stuff, not so much about you. So let's start there. Tell me about your upbringing, family dynamic. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in California in the 1970s, and my mother had come to the United States in 1958 to pursue a PhD. She was born in Lahore before partition and then grew up in Delhi and applied to come to the United States to do a PhD. That was 1958, as I mentioned, and there were very, very few South Asian women here on their own doing PhDs. But this was one of the exceptions of the immigration law at the time.
At the time, Asian immigration was banned, right?
Yes. It didn't open up again really until 1965, but in a very limited way, where the 1965 Immigration Act favored specific categories of people from South Asia, engineers and scientists, doctors, etc. But U.S. immigration laws, even the Asian exclusion laws from the very beginning, had a set of exceptions. And one of those exceptions was students. So students from South Asia, you know, have been able to come here since, you know, the early 20th century.
That's so interesting. So even during the ban, students were able to come to the U.S.
Yes.
Fascinating.
It also meant that, for example, in the early 20th century, there was a whole group of Indian students at UC Berkeley and at a few other campuses. But at Berkeley, those students got involved in expatriate anti-British independence movement work, along with Punjabi farmers and workers who had come to California really early on, around 1907, and political exiles as well. And those three groups kind of came together in the formation of an independence movement called the Gadar Movement.
But I assume Punjabi farmers took a different pathway to the United States versus students who were coming, right?
Yes. And the sort of accepted or previously known historical narrative of South Asians coming to the United States, for those who cared to learn about it and study about it, there was a wave of migration from Punjab, predominantly Sikhs, but also Muslims, who came to initially to Vancouver and that area in British Columbia around the turn of the 20th century, and then began to cross the border into Washington State and Oregon around 1906, 1907, where initially they were working in factories, in lumber mills, and on the railways to some extent. And then there were a series of campaigns by white workers to drive them out. The first really mass-scale violence against South Asians in the U.S. happened in 1907 in Bellingham, Washington, where white workers came together under the prompting of a party called the Asiatic Exclusion League and rioted in Bellingham and forced all the Punjabi workers out of their homes and beat them and stole from them and drove them back across the border into Canada. Mm. That early history then also sort of made its way down into California, because ultimately more of the Punjabis started coming through San Francisco, and those who were in Washington and Oregon made their way down into California, where they became farm workers and ultimately eventually started their own farms. In some cases, they married predominantly Mexican-American women. And then the understanding of the South Asian American history was that after 1917, the door closed.
Mm.
1917, there was a large-scale immigration bill that was passed that sometimes referred to as the Asiatic Barred Zone Act, which barred the migration of South Asians, South Asian workers in particular, and lasted until 1965. So there was this assumption that between 1917 and 1965, there was no significant South Asian immigration to the U.S. And this is where Aluddin's father's story, which is the kernel of the film, comes in.
We'll get to Alauddin's father's story, but I want to go back to your mom's journey. So she came here in 1958 as
yes.
a PhD student.
Yes.
Did she come to California?
No, she went to Harvard. So she finished at Harvard in around 1962, 1963. That's when she met my father, who was from Australia of Scottish descent. And, you know, my mother, she was a feminist, anti-imperialist.
All the good stuff.
Yeah, whose work was on Indian nationalist novelists. And she began seeking out work within U.S. academia in when she finished her PhD, and all of her Harvard professors said, oh, with a degree from Harvard, you can get a job anywhere, you can do anything you want. But for her, as a South Asian woman who always wore a sari in public, who was a feminist and whose work centered on anti-colonialism and the post-colonial third world and women in particular in the third world, she couldn't get a job for my entire childhood.
Oh, wow.
She was sort of hired on as a part-time adjunct lecturer and continued in that way for years and years before she was able to get a job that was a tenure-track job at a university.
Vivek, how did that influence you, your mother's path, being a very smart woman, feminist, really unencumbered by what the world was telling her, right? She plowed through. How did it shape you?
Well, two things. One is that the way that she taught my brother and me about our South Asian-ness or Indian-ness was always centered on history and politics. It wasn't about Bollywood films or particular foods or whatever. You know, we grew up hearing about partition. Her mother and her grandmother were both involved in the independence movement. So, you know, I heard stories about my grandmother singing songs in front of British jails in Lahore that were meant to shame the Indian police officers for cooperating with the British and holding political prisoners inside the jails. And stories about my grandmother with other women collecting British fabrics, British clothing, and heaping it into the middle of the street and burning it.
They were pretty badass women, right?
Yeah. And then, you know, in Riverside, as I mentioned, my mother became sort of a magnet for a whole group of graduate students who were at UCR in the 70s, who were from different parts of the decolonizing world, from South Asia and the Middle East and Africa and Latin America. And so, you know, we lived in a predominantly white suburb, but our house, inside the house was the site of these really regular potlucks where all of her graduate students and some other professors would be there talking about what was often referred to in those days as the revolution, about the decolonial transformation of the world. And that was a moment when the idea of pan-third world solidarity that was also inclusive of African-American and other struggles in the United States. That was a time when that was really palpable as a political project. So I grew up around that as well. And all of that influenced the path that I would take later.
Which is?
Well, initially in college, I studied political theory. But then when I finished, I really wanted to engage in the world in a way that was not about theories and about being in the ivory tower and discussing theoretical issues, but rather engaged in the world in some way that centered around everyday struggles for social change. And so ultimately, a year or so out of college, I got an internship at KQED, which is the San Francisco's PBS station, where I was plucked out of the intern pool to do research for a documentary on police brutality in San Francisco. And I had had my own experience, which was also very formative for me when I was 18. I was mistaken for someone the police were chasing, someone described as having dark, bushy hair, which is what I had at the time, but which was also sort of, in California at that time, it was a sort of racial euphemism that was usually used for Mexican-American. It just changed me in a really deep way in terms of my felt understanding of the so-called justice system and race and class and all of that. So as about a 20-year-old, when I got this opportunity to work on a documentary about police brutality in San Francisco, and for 10 months I was researching cases and reading really awful, violent incidents of police brutality for that 10-month period of time. And then I saw how the producer directors of the documentary kind of took that work and molded it into a really moving and indicting film that aired on KQED. And then I saw that how that film did the usual thing, you know, the response was the usual response, where there was a little bit of a shakeup in the police department, and then things went on as they had been in the past. But what happened with that film also was that cassette copies of the film started circulating in the neighborhoods, predominantly African-American neighborhoods, where the police were perpetrating the majority of this violence. And the film became a resource from within the communities. It really solidified my sense of documentary as a medium of political change, of social and political communication. And that sort of set me on my path to make documentaries.
Vivek, fast forward to now. This is a great segue into your current documentary. What led to the decision to focus your work on South Asian migration, specifically about such a niche topic?
When I moved from the Bay Area to New York, this was about 1989, for the first time found a community of other second-generation South Asian folks, especially as the 90s got going. There was kind of a cultural and political critical mass among South Asian youth who were predominantly children of migrants who came after the 1965 Immigration Act. But among those folks and others, there were groups who were starting to address the issues facing South Asian communities in the U.S. And throughout the 90s were a period in New York City where all kinds of different political, social, and arts organizations and collectives were being formed among young South Asians. So that became my community. And I started working on my first documentary at that time, which was about South Asian taxi drivers from, you know, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India, who at that moment in the early 90s became the majority group among taxi drivers in New York City. And, you know, what I saw off the bat was that on the one hand, this more recent group of migrants who were more working class and were facing violence as part of their jobs and indifference and even hostility from the New York City police and government, you know, which was for a long stretch under the mayorship of Rudy Giuliani. And then also I saw that it was very clear that the generation of South Asian immigrants who came after the 1965 Act, who were predominantly Indian at that time, and who were from these backgrounds as engineers and doctors and such, by that time had sort of established a kind of footing in the U.S., but were very much living in the predominantly white suburbs and following this path of model minority. And they really didn't want to have anything to do with the more recent immigrations. And at the same time, it was that earlier post-65 generation of South Asian, predominantly Indian professionals who really had control of the representation of the South Asian communities.
They were basically driving the narrative around South Asian identity in the U.S.
Right. This is the narrative that brought Aladdin and me together, or the quest, really, on one level. So in that period of the 90s, Aladdin was part of this generation that I described of South Asian American artists and activists. His background, though, was different from the second-gen folks who were the children of 1965, post-65 immigrants. He had grown up in Spanish Harlem in the Washington Carver Projects. So Aladdin's father had come to the United States in the 1920s. He had married a Puerto Rican woman in Spanish Harlem and had two kids who were Aladdin's older half-siblings. After Aladdin's father's first wife, Victoria, passed away, Aladdin's father then was on his own for a number of years. And in his older years, he went back to Bangladesh, to his village, in order to remarry. And the woman he remarried, Mohima, was Aladdin's mother.
And she was quite young when he married her.
She was quite young. After Aladdin's father remarried Mohima, he brought Mohima to live with him in East Harlem. And they had two children, first Aladdin's older brother, Kareem, and then Aladdin. And then Aladdin's father died when Aladdin was about 14, leaving Mohima to bring up the boys on her own in a place that was, you know, where she was really struggling in many ways.
Mm.
Aladdin himself then, you know, really connected with hip hop and eventually with comedy, and had a difficult relationship with both of his parents and really went on his own path. And when Aladdin and I met in 1999, he was doing stand-up comedy and starting to work on his own writing as well. But he had seen my documentary Taxiwala and had liked it. And he came up to me and he said, I want to make a documentary about my father. And when he started telling me his father's story, which, you know, I mentioned before, was that his father came in the 1920s, married a Puerto Rican woman, had kids, you know, essentially lived his entire adult life in the United States at a time when South Asian migration to the U.S. was banned.
Vivek, but this was not one story, right? His father was not an outlier. This was a common occurrence happening at the time.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about that.
We didn't know that at the time, right? So Aladdin did know that when he was growing up in Harlem, there was a small circle of friends of his father who were also Bengali Muslim men, you know, men from what's now Bangladesh, who had settled in Harlem, and a lot of them kind of moved out to different parts, different boroughs, and had married African-American and Puerto Rican women. So Aladdin knew that there was this small circle, but what wasn't clear, especially to me as someone who, you know, I thought I knew South Asian American history fairly well, what wasn't clear was whether Aladdin's father and his small circle of friends were just a kind of anomaly, that, you know, this group that somehow made it from East Bengal to East Harlem in the 1920s and 30s and lived undocumented all those years and intermarried, etc. You know, was that just this isolated phenomena with Aladdin's father and friends, or was there something bigger? And so, you know, Aladdin had his own set of questions about his father and about his father's life and his decisions. And he started reaching out to everyone he could find who were part of that circle, children of some of the other Bangladeshi Muslim men who were Aladdin's father's friends. And, you know, also one friend of Aladdin's father who was still alive, Masood Chowdhury. So he started reaching out to his older half-brother, to others that he remembered from his childhood. And I entered a PhD program with the specific purpose of answering the question, was Aladdin's father and his friends an isolated group of migrants, or were they part of a larger history? And when I started pulling on the thread, Aladdin's father's story, and started diving into the archives, on one hand, I discovered that I am an archive geek and I love doing that work. But as I dug further and further into the archives, it became clear that Aladdin's father and his friends were actually part of an unknown history of predominantly Bengali Muslim men from present-day Bangladesh, from places like Noakhali and Sylhet, who had come to the United States in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, were ship workers on British steamships where they were treated awfully. They were on indenture-like contracts, and that Aladdin's father and friends were part of this larger history of ship workers who jumped ship in New York City in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, and settled in African-American and Puerto Rican neighborhoods. He started new lives. Then when I started widened the search to look at things like ship records and census records, etc., it just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
And the story came together.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched the documentary, and it's a fascinating story of great perseverance, interracial solidarity that we don't see among South Asian immigrants of present. I don't see that as a South Asian immigrant. And there could be so many different reasons. One being after 1965, South Asian immigrants who came probably from privileged backgrounds, and there is this socioeconomic dynamic that plays into how they perceive different communities within the United States and how for them their goal or priority becomes approximation to whiteness, which means anti-Black racism and also living in these different silos. And we could have another episode yes. about that. What really intrigued me about this documentary was these stories are personal, right? These stories, as part of your research process, are people's lived experiences. How did you encourage them to tell these stories? Because I assume sometimes these stories may be painful to share.
Mm-hmm. This is where the partnership collaboration with Aladdin was really crucial and was, you know, from the beginning, it was about the two of us kind of following different paths to try and find out more answers about this earlier generation. And as I mentioned, in Aladdin's case, he started reaching out first to his half-brother. We did a really early interview with in 2004, I think. His father's best friend, Masood Chowdhury, who lived in another housing project on the Upper West Side. And so it was through Aladdin's family connections that all the initial interviews came about. And in the interviews, it was sort of this tag team that we developed where I had a series of questions on a sheet of paper that I wanted to cover, that a lot of which came out of the research that I was doing in the archives and trying to find out the human side of the story that I was learning in the archives. So often we would start with those questions and then but then Aladdin would then come in with his own questions that were, number one, you know, in some ways more personal because they were about his father at that time, mostly about trying to figure out why his father made certain decisions, like why did his father marry a much younger woman, knowing that he would pass away and leave his wife and kids to fend for themselves.
So did you find an answer to that?
I think Aladdin came to a better understanding of that. To continue, so then our interview process, you know, because Aladdin already was familiar with the folks who we were interviewing, the portions of each interview that we did where he asked questions, there was a comfort on the one hand and a familiarity. So Aladdin was able to engage in more conversations, essentially, that then added to all of what I had been asking in my part of the interviews.
Mm.
So that made for a really rich conversation with the various people we interviewed.
Vivek, if you could make a part two to In Search of Bengali Harlem, what additions would you make to the story arc?
That's a good question. I'm so deeply in this film and we're trying to get it out into the world for people to see. And, you know, we've had these amazing experiences at film festivals where in New York in particular, we had screenings that were predominantly South Asian audiences, but also predominantly of color audiences, basically, but a large group in each case of Bangladeshi Americans and a lot of younger Bangladeshi Americans. And they were really, you know, emotionally moving, those experiences. There was a kind of set of conversations that came out of the film among those audiences that was really deep about intergenerational healing, about remembering our, you know, immigrant parents, honoring their past and their struggles, and about cross-racial unity and solidarity and life-making.
So we were trying to figure out who some of these people were because we didn't have a clue. Talking to Habib was like pushing a door open and seeing a glimpse of this whole other world. All these families, these Muslim men from Bengali villages, and their African-American and Puerto Rican wives. My dad was in the middle of that world. He had this whole other life.
See, you never knew him as I did when he was a young man.
Yeah.
But you could tell we went to the beach a lot.
Yeah, that's a quintessential picture.
And you know how now people bring fried chicken and all that? Pat would bring pot of curry, rice.
But not that three-tier. That's what I'm thinking,
Tiffin.
No, a regular pot.
I think in some ways the follow-up to the film is actually that kind of work. You know, we want the film to work in that way, to reach audiences and to resonate with audiences, South Asian, African-American, Puerto Rican, broader American audiences, in ways that start conversations around cross-racial solidarity and cross-racial life-making on the one hand, and intergenerational healing on the other, sort of healing the traumas immigrant parents often come from and are bringing with them, as well as the trauma of migration itself.
Was there anything that really stood out to you through this process, aside from the story itself, which is quite fascinating, something that you weren't expecting?
What I didn't expect was just how large and significant a history or histories there were of Bengali Muslim migrants coming to the U.S. in the early 20th century. And, you know, one of the offshoots of the research was that as I was researching the intermarriages, the Harlem and Lower East Side, I came across marriage records for two brothers. One was named Bahadur Ali and the other, I'm forgetting his name, but the two of them married African-American women in Harlem in the 1920s. But on their marriage certificates, it listed their parents as being their father, Moksud Ali, and their mother, Ella Blackman. And one of those brothers was born in Mississippi around 1900, and the other was born in New Orleans. And so among these records of ship jumpers, there were these other two records of people who were actually second generation and mixed South Asian and African American who had been born at the turn of the century in New Orleans and Mississippi. That led to the discovery of a whole other early migration, also of Bengali Muslim men, but from a region north of Calcutta called Hooghly, where there had been a village-based industry of embroidered fabric called chikun embroidery, which is often connected to Lucknow, but also was produced in villages in Hooghly. So Moksud Ali, for example, came to the United States in the 1880s and married Ella Blackman around 1890 or 1888. And what the group that he was part of, it turned out, were men from Hooghly who came to the United States starting in the 1880s to sell what was then called, in those days in the U.S., Oriental goods. But what they were selling specifically was embroidered fabrics. You know, tablecloths and bedspreads and wall hangings, etc., in the chikun style that were produced for generations among their families in Hooghly. So those men came every year, you know, in groups through Ellis Island, would sell their goods first to tourists in the beach boardwalks of New Jersey, and then they headed south for the rest of the year and established a base in New Orleans, which itself was, you know, remaking itself as a tourist city. And they basically followed the tourists and throughout different parts of the South and into the Caribbean, and created an entire network for selling these goods to Americans.
Vivek, just to clarify, at the time when most of these men came to the U.S. and stayed for various reasons, and they were undocumented, when they married Puerto Rican and Black women, they did not automatically get citizenship, right? There was no path to do citizenship through marriage at the time. In fact, the law stipulated that if any woman married what they called a foreign man, her citizenship would be revoked, right?
So there were laws that were passed in the early 20th century of that kind. Yeah. One famous case of an Indian nationalist who had settled in the U.S. and married an American woman whose citizenship was revoked. Since the populations that I'm talking about, the peddlers and the ship workers, sort of just remained under the radar.
Did they remain undocumented throughout?
Yes. Especially, you know, Aladdin's father and his circle and that group of former ship workers. But they also engaged in activism to change the laws. Someone who Aladdin grew up calling Chacha, uncle, Ibrahim Chowdhury, who was a friend of his father, Habib's, was actually a community leader among the Bengali Muslim ship jumpers who had settled in New York and elsewhere. And in the late 30s and early 40s, there was a push by a number of Indian Americans who were here, who were, again, from more privileged backgrounds. They started lobbying Congress to try to change the immigration laws, at least to allow for the naturalization of 100 people a year from India. And this is when India was still British India, that included what became Bangladesh.
Right.
And one of the things that I found in the congressional records was a statement by Ibrahim Chowdhury, Aladdin's chacha, that was submitted as part of the lobbying efforts in Congress, in which Ibrahim Chowdhury said, you know, I'm not here to speak about the students and the doctors and the engineers and the business people. You know, those were some of the folks who were pushing for these changes. He said, I'm here to talk about and speak for factory workers and the restaurant workers and the workers in the field. And what he and a group of others were pushing for was actually the normalization of the immigration status of those who had come, you know, as either farmers or you know, the ship jumpers, and who had remained undocumented for this whole period from the 1910s into the 1930s and 40s. And it was a really powerful statement that then made it into the congressional record. And when there was a change in the laws in the 1940s, you know, an initial step forward in terms of a quota of who could be naturalized, this was also part of what got passed, a kind of pathway for those who were undocumented for all those years from the 1910s and 20s.
But Alauddin's father did not take advantage of that.
Well, he did eventually.
Oh, he did.
Yes, as did a number of others.
What a beautiful story. I mean, it's incredible. As an immigrant, after doing all this research and watching the documentary, I realized how limited my knowledge is when it comes to immigration and different pathways, because most of the time I look at other immigrants through the lens of my lived experiences, coming here for college and then settling down. This is such an important work, Vivek, and I'm so glad that you undertook this project. In the end, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
Oh, boy. Can I pass on that question?
Tell me, where can people find this documentary? I watched it on YouTube, but is there any other platform that they can go and watch it on?
Yeah.
And is there a website that they can go and check out all the work and more information?
Yes. So it's In Search of Bengali Harlem, directed by myself and Aladdin Ullah. And it's premiered as part of the PBS/World Channel's program, America Reframed, and is now available to stream using the PBS app, online on YouTube, on the World Channel's YouTube channel, or if you go to PBS website or the America Reframed website. And all of those different means of watching the film are also listed on our website, which is BengaliHarlem.com. And you can go directly to BengaliHarlem.com/watch, and it'll list all the ways that you can watch the film.
Thank you so much, Vivek.
Thank you so much for having me.
What a fun conversation. More than fun, what an important conversation. In Search of Bengali Harlem. It's an important documentary. If you haven't seen it, please do. I promise you won't be disappointed. This episode was produced by me, written by Adiba Hussain and me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Hazik Ahmed Farid. Immigrantly's theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Come back next week when I bring you another important, incredible, amazing, unheard of story. Take care.